Thanks very much, and thank you again to Diego for all of the work you've done in organising this conference. So I'm currently midway through a project called Plastic Childhoods, whose aim is to understand multiple entanglements of children's lives with plastics. The starting point is plastic's centrality to questions of the Anthropocene, and in particular its ubiquity and presence at different scales. Inevitably, though, plastics are attached to and crossed with other stuff, metals and other elements that have to varying degrees been created by humans, hence the subtitle here. And the importance of this observation about matters other than plastics will hopefully become clearer later. So I want to say a little bit more about the project, funded by the UK's Leverhulme Trust, on which this talk is based. The research is underpinned by non-representational, new materialist and post-humanist approaches to childhood. In that light, the project seeks to examine the manifold ways in which childhoods and plastics are entangled. To greater and lesser extents, I seek to de-centre children themselves to follow different materials and bodies and flows at different spatial and temporal scales. So the easiest way I find to articulate this is to think of different cuts, different transects or vectors, both of and through the comings together of childhood and plastics. As you'll see, this means a fair degree of eclecticism, but certainly an impulse to move beyond traditional phenomenological approaches that foreground children's voices and experiences, although they're by no means absent from my work. So the images here afford a sense of those cuts. The top left, some social media analyses of eBay and Twitter, which have involved quantitative analyses of social networks via hashtags, tweet intensity, sentiment analysis, followed by more detailed content analyses. The middle and top right, and also the image at the bottom, all show a four-month-long intensive collaborative programme of work with a local secondary school, working with 13 young people aged 12 to 15. And this work has involved a series of interactive workshops, some co-delivered with local artists, all of which have sought to explore young people's views and co-develop knowledge about their various engagements with plastics. The work also involved a bespoke mobile phone app, which I can say more about later, which enables us to map their mobilities and interactions with plastics, and also for them to take photographs, and more traditional interviews that involved thinking about those mobilities. Finally, and what you can see in the image there is two young people doing what are called EBC, or breath condensate tests. We worked with environmental nanoscientists in our school, and we trained the students themselves, taking samples of soil, water, breath and urine to determine the presence of plastics and other materials in children's bodies and in their environments. Now, I'd be very happy to say much more about the methods and also the quite obvious ethical concerns that underpin this research. But for now, I want to ask, what might those cuts through the earth and through childhoods look like? So I want to tell a series of deliberately provisional, slightly disjointed, but nonetheless associated stories from the project, which I want to theorise along four thematics. Handily, these all begin with the letter V, just so I don't forget them. And I argue that these are constitutive of what I term our plastic moment, and that our is in inverted commas because of its situatedness. So this idea of a plastic moment, certainly from the UK perspective, is meant in two ways. Firstly, a fairly sudden and immediate interrogation of all things plastic. After the airing of the final episode of the natural history programme Blue Planet a couple of years ago. But this is also a moment of what Levi Bryant, the object-oriented ontologist, would, riffing on Catherine Malabou's work, term a kind of machinic or operational plasticity, in which our relationship with matter is bending and being recalibrated, and in which we are too. These are predominantly, but not only, matters of knowledge about the environment. Rather, in this plastic moment, there are recalibrations in terms of our emotional and embodied relationships with matters that we take for granted, and to which we've become habituated. And it's for this reason that I want to start with this idea of visceralities. So, as you've just seen, the headlines and social media responses surrounding the airing of Blue Planet 2 last year play on the massing, affective, visceral responses that the programme spawned. Now, our analyses of millions of tweets and retweets from selected hashtags, which you can see along the side of the chart, all involving children and or plastics, bear this out in a much more simplistic sense. This sentiment analysis, which not unproblematically differentiates between positive and negative proportions of tweets, shows that the only two with net negative sentiment were plastic and oceans, perhaps unsurprisingly, and plastic and toys, perhaps more so. A word cloud derived from 140,000 tweets mentioning plastic in January this year shows something of the emotive nature of these debates. But it also, with surgery being front and centre, acts as a further reminder of the multiply embodied, visceral ways in which plastics are both metaphorically and literally internalised into human and other lives. In our work at the secondary school, we manufactured a number of encounters with plastics that look rather different but related. So we looked at the properties of different plastics, encouraging the students to touch, stretch, reconsider and experiment with plastic objects, usually classified as waste or at best as virtually worthless. So a final activity, illustrated here, was a collaboration with some local artists. The aim was to create some totem poles made from a range of plastic objects found, bought, and otherwise procured by the artists. After lengthy deliberation before the workshop, we decided to use the term totem poles for several reasons, even though we were well aware of the potentially colonising and culturally imperialist implications of doing so. Firstly, as the final activity before we finished in the school, we wanted to unsettle and defamiliarise the students with plastics again. Through all of the activities and the research that they'd done, they'd become comfortable with their knowledge, with many of them knowing far more than we as researchers and teachers do about plastics. This was, of course, a good thing, but we wanted to end the project with a sense that our relationships with plastics were and are and can only be provisional and troubling, not least because of the longer lives of plastics that exceed human generations. Secondly, and drawing on this brief discussion of place we had earlier, we wanted students to think about the co-implication of their lives with plastics with those of others elsewhere. One way to do this, not least because I and the teachers are geographers, was to ask them to consider how plastics are materialised and embodied in other places, whether on the North American continent or elsewhere. Thirdly, the totem poles enabled another new cut through plastics and childhoods. The objects were found by the artists, not the children, and in themselves had travelled along diverse vectors through manufacture, selling, recycling and divestment. Many were found in charity shops, in skips and on waste sites. And finally, because of their vertical orientation, the creation of the totem poles afforded forms of categorisation that in turn generated multiple conversations, judgments and performances. And those performances were aesthetic, material and ethical, as the students were given these kind of piles of rubbish, there's a prosthetic leg in case you wonder what that is, in the foreground, to play with and to use in their work. And we provided different sets of instructions. Create a totem pole that looks good. Create one that shows what plastics mean to you. Create one that shows the value of different plastics. The one on the right was particularly interesting to us because of the different values that students saw imbued in these plastics. The utility of the safety helmet, the importance of plastics that can help us to keep things alive in the watering can, and the emotional and social value they saw in the bunch of plastic flowers. And we talked about why they're so important to people who place them on graves if they can't visit a deceased person's grave regularly and lay real flowers. So they also associated some of these plastics with living well, despite their overwhelmingly critical view of plastic. So in a different cut, I want to take you elsewhere, and to a cut that's visceral in a very different way. What's so striking about this plastic moment is the sheer scale of the debate and of the very material processes in which plastics are entwined. With the work of Catherine Yusof, Astrida Neimanis and others in mind, I want next to think about plastic vortices, as plastics become earth, they become geological or become hydrological. Perhaps the juxtaposition with what the students had to say about how plastics may support life is also particularly stark in this example. So this image is taken off the island of Roatan in the Caribbean Sea. This is one of many oceanic trash vortices, the most famous and largest being in the Pacific Ocean. These are massive rafts of assembled detritus, swirling, entangling, and decaying with different speeds and slownesses. And they're not only composed of plastics, but woods, metals, vegetation, feathers, and no doubt an array of marine life, both living and dead. So again, plastics are entangled with other stuff, as I mentioned at the beginning. So we came across this video through our social media analyses. I can't play the video, but as the bemused voices in the background, apparently taken on a tourist boat ride, list off the objects they see plastics, and specifically the ordinary plastics constitutive of especially Western childhoods. And for me, this listing is reminiscent of Bruno Latour's evocation of the uncanniness of listing apparently ordinary objects. As he argues, to apprehend the most quotidian of objects from an estranged vantage point, an idyllic Caribbean boat ride that takes on a monstrous turn, and to list them off, as we hear a female American voice in the background, calmly pointing out children's sandals, dolls, toy cars, and bottles, is to make it matter again, or to make it matter differently. This listing, then, of particular plastic items, and the effects and affects that listing creates, are part of our plastic moment in ways that trouble and enable us to stay with the trouble, just as we sought to do in the work on the totem poles in Birmingham. A third cut, which very much involves both viscералities and vortices, is that of the vector. We, and I mean we as academics as well as a species, are quickly gathering increasingly worrying but compelling evidence about the multiple scales at which plastics are entangled in our lives and with and as the Earth. And this extends beyond the sheer scale of oceanic trash vortices. For instance, there are studies about the presence of plastics in fish that then enter the human food system. And then there's this, a recent study by the University of Reading that found that mosquitoes represent a new pathway for plastic pollution. During their development, mosquito larvae can ingest tiny plastic particles which remain in their bodies as they become fully grown insects. Then as food for larger animals, those same plastics can enter animal and then human food chains. So plastics circulate at the microscopic and, as we'll see, at the nanoscopic scale beyond human perception, but they also circulate at the very largest scale. And so at the end, if there's time, I'd like to come back to the idea of plastics as a kind of hyper-object, as Timothy Morton puts it. Now, staying with vectors, we're still analysing the samples taken from our work at the school, especially the plastics, so I can't report on the plastics specifically. Yet, in looking at the samples, we found other stuff associated with the becoming Earth and of human action. Those stuffs are, like plastics, simultaneously visceral, embodied and materialised in earthly systems, including in children's bodies, and also troubling in terms of how we theorise them. They evade the object-like, bounded, hasetic materialities so commonly the focus for recent childhood studies. Indeed, perhaps with Donna Haraway's... is that till 20 minutes or 15?
1 minute to 20.
To 20? All right. Okay.
I've got five.
Okay, that's great. So I'd like to talk about this. So with Donna Haraway's speculative modes of writing in mind, the methods available to us through environmental and nanoscience are both promising but also troubling when it comes to assessing what Jane Bennett terms the lives of metals and other stuff. And they're promising because they enable us to take a different cut on how plastics and other materials emerge and work through human lives, but they can't tell us everything. So in our consideration of more than 30 trace elements and metals that we found in the samples, we've been engaged with the environmental nanoscientists in our school in a process of conversation and mutual learning. So for these three elements, for instance, in each case we found higher, but not dangerous levels of each element than we were expecting. In each case we can be quite precise about where these elements could have come from and how they appeared in children's bodies, but not necessarily precise about exactly where they came from. So some kind of level of speculation and storing and collaborative exercises is required. So levels of aluminium, for instance, were high across the board in the breath condensate and soil samples. Aluminium is released into the atmosphere through the smelting industries. So our explanation for this could be one that extends back across generations, in that Birmingham was one of the centres of the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century, a centre of smelting and other industries, and that there are still pockets of businesses that use aluminium in Birmingham today. So one of the sources could have been that. But aluminium is also released from vehicles, and levels were higher at the school near a major road, and also for those students who lived along major roads. Meanwhile, aluminium can cross into the body through more surprising routes, particularly through its use in nanoscopic form in deodorants to help with their application and their effectiveness. And many of the students in the work they did took pictures of cosmetics and other nano-containing products. So finally, how long have I got left?
A few minutes, sure.
A couple of minutes, okay. So finally, I want to highlight the crucial role of media, and especially digital media, in constituting our plastic moment. As Levi Bryant argues, in part following Marshall McLuhan, media are not simply representations, but constituents of machinic assemblages that render human being. So a particular consideration for the Plastic Childhoods Project has been about how plastic toys and other stuff associated with childhoods is increasingly represented, made present, bought, sold, and circulated online. These plastics have, like many of us, data selves. Platforms like eBay provide repositories, archives, and resources that make visible the sheer diversity, size, and scale of our plastic addiction. They're constitutive of our plastic moment. So a quick look at some of the figures from our scrape of eBay using an API is indicative of this. In just 1 month, we found 33,000 toy cars, 871,000 dolls, over 4.5 million baby-related items from bottles to prams, and curiously, nearly 120,000 lunchboxes. Many of these never sold. Oops, sorry. So there are various ways that we can think about these, and one of the most helpful I found has actually come from archaeologies of childhood, where archaeologists like Sally Crawford use similarly kind of speculative methods to think about the biographies of objects as they pass from adults to children, things that may have become toys even if they weren't designed toys. And through the kind of virtual archaeologies, the online archaeologies that we've done, we've tried to do the same, to try and follow some of the stories of these objects. For instance, here is this toy car, which was once much loved by a child, has become a collector's object. And I can say more about the kind of use of eBay as a kind of repository for these kinds of objects later on. So just to finish, I don't have time to talk about this, but just to say that one of the ways in which we're trying to think through the presence of plastics is as what Timothy Morton terms a kind of hyper-object, something that's both too small and too large, both in temporal and spatial horizons, for us to perceive, but that I hope that some of these different cuts through plastics and through the earth can begin to point to. Even at the same time, as Morton's notion of the hyperobject in the Anthropocene doesn't necessarily attend for the ways in which those crossings of plastics with a human might be cut across again by different forms of social difference. So, just to finish then, I think plastics and stuff like them raise difficult questions. Crucially, these are linked. Firstly, how to deal with these unbounded, uncomfortable, elusive, and slippery materialities, such as plastics and other stuff. How to address the homogenising, technocentric, phallocentric discourses of the Anthropocene, for instance, in trying to tell some of these small stories that I've tried to tell with children and young people, and which we're continuing to tell in our work. And simultaneously, how to both decenter children and young people, for instance, in those social media or nanoscientific analyses, and to recenter them in ways that generate critical debates about our current and future entanglements with plastics. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to invite Veronica up.